I think people do get worried about that. Like, what if the sex is bad? Then there's an opportunity to work and to grow together. When people are like, oh, sex is bad. And I'm like, you know, but like, it's also kind of like pizza, where it's like, even when you have bad pizza, you're like, oh, it's still pizza. And it's still pizza. And like, what could I tweak? What could we do about that? The time when sex, when women will say this sex was really bad, is when they felt neglected, ignored. Their partner was maybe self-absorbed, not actually, like, their partner was essentially just going through the motions of sex and using their body as a means to an end.
I'm Doug Bopes, personal trainer, best-selling author, and entrepreneur, and I'm on a mission to help others become the best version of themselves. So I'd like to welcome you to the Adversity Advantage podcast, where we will help you use obstacles, failures, and setbacks to give you that edge needed for success. I'll be interviewing people from all walks of life on how they overcame trials and turned them into triumphs. So please sit back, relax, and get ready to be absolutely blown away by some of the wisdom and stories you're about to hear. Welcome back to another episode of the Adversity Advantage. I'm your host, Doug Bopes, and today's guest is Dr. Jolene Brighton. Dr. Brighton is a board-certified naturopathic endocrinologist, a clinical sexologist, and prominent leader in women's medicine. She's a fierce patient advocate and completely dedicated to uncovering the root cause of hormonal imbalances, and Dr. Brighton empowers women worldwide to take control of their health and their hormones. She's also an international speaker, clinical educator, medical advisor within the tech community, and considered a leading authority on women's health. Today on the show, we discuss the fastest way to turn a woman on or off, how to effectively communicate with your partner about sex, why understanding your partner's cycle is so crucial, how stress can make or break your sex life, what the research actually says about the best way to pleasure your partner, some common misconceptions about sexual desire, what most men get wrong when it comes to sex, why orgasms aren't necessarily a sign of good sex, and so much more. So let's get this conversation going and welcome Dr. Jolene Brighton to the Adversity Advantage podcast. Dr. Brighton, welcome to the podcast.
Hey there. Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. I'm super excited for this conversation, and I'd love to jump right in. And I'd love to know, given all your research, your expertise, what do you think is the fastest way to turn a woman off sexually?
If you are in a relationship and she asks you to do something, you say, okay, just make me a list. Or, okay, then I need you to do this. So what is that? That is, she has communicated, I need to pass this thing that's a mental burden to me onto you. I need task sharing. And you instead say, okay, except I need you to do all of these extra things for me to be able to complete the task. And if people are listening to this and they're like, well, why does that matter? Because the mental load that women are carrying in relationships, in households, especially if they are mothers as well, it is something that weighs on their nervous system. It weighs on their stress system. So what is happening with their stress hormones? And anything you can do to ease up stress, mental burden, nervous system chaos, that is going to make it so that she has more energy and is more receptive to any sexual advances. And that might feel something, you know, if that's not your norm, that doesn't feel like that's something that you operate with, you might feel confusing. But for women, our bodies are constantly surveying the environment for whether it's safe or not. Is it plentiful? Are there enough nutrients? And our stress directly influences how our hormones operate. And if the signal from the environment is that stress is really high, it is not a good time to have a baby. Whether or not you want to have a baby, the body says, sex leads to a reproductive outcome, which is possibly a new human. And if the environment is not safe for that, then the first thing that the body's going to do is shut down, not just sexual desire, but the ability to receive the sexual stimuli, the input that gets you in the mood.
Yeah. So then would the opposite also be true? Is the fastest way to turn a woman on sexually is to help her relieve of her stress and some of her like mental overwhelm that may exist?
Hallmark will never tell you this secret, right? They're like, buy the card. Hershey's is like, buy the chocolate, like do all of these things. And in reality is that when we think about foreplay, people often are like, oh, that just means like stuff that starts in the bedroom. Foreplay for women starts the moment you wake up. This If anybody pauses, if you're a man and you're like, oh God, like that sounds so daunting. No, there's so much opportunity. You have a full day of opportunity. So it's the little things that really add up that when you are leaving what the researchers Bancroft and Jansen call the breaks, these are really the breaks on what stops someone from getting in the mood. I don't know how much of your audience is male, but I do want people to understand that that research was first, that whole model was developed for men. So this affects everybody in this way, but for women, our bodies are especially sensitive to the environment. So if you're a man listening to this and you're like, this is true for me too, that's so good that you identify that, because these breaks, these things like relationship stressors, stressors that they have at work, being touched out by children. This is a phenomenon that happens where your children are touching you all day and hanging on you all day. And at the end of the day, you're like, I cannot be touched by anybody because it's just, it's been overwhelming. But if you can start releasing the breaks, the things that are within your control, because there's stuff that are breaks that are, that is only in her control, like body image issues. She's got to work on that. You can give her compliments, but you know, there's a lot of work to do on her end as well. But if you can release those breaks, then whatever you know gets her in the mood. If you're like, oh yes, when I kiss her neck, that's the thing. When you go to do that, her nervous system will be set up to receive that signal. Her nervous system will be like, oh, this is pleasurable. We like pleasure. We have capacity and energy for pleasure. Let's go.
So you're saying foreplay starts in the morning and that women respond differently than men? Like men are just like, I'm going to flip a switch. Let's just go. And women are like, whoa, 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 whoa. I need a bit more than that.
Not all men. So here's the thing. That is like a myth that's pervasive in society, is that men are like light switches. You just turn them on and turn them off. And then, you know, some people are like, well, then that should apply to women as well. And it's so much more complex than that. There's all, so I talk about in Is This Normal, my book, the case of Jill, who had all of these stressful events of the day. So I like to think about the nervous system being a train track, and the train is that sexual signal. There are breaks that can happen throughout the day. So that's that dual control model that I was referencing. So that might be your boss is yelling at you, break gets laid down. Your kid got in a fight at school and you had to deal with the principal on your own, like break is laid down. Then your partner gets home and you're like, hey, where's that takeout you said you'd pick up? And they're like, sorry, the game's on and I didn't want to miss it. So can you just whip up something quickly? Okay, break's been laid down. And then when the game's over, you go to your partner and you say, you know, the sweet words that she likes or the things that typically get her in the mood. But when that train starts to go, it hits too many breaks along the way. And so it is a lot more complex. And as I said, that model was actually based on men. And then they went on to research it in women. And so this idea of gas pedal and brake, this can apply to anyone. But also if you are someone who's like, no, it is a light switch for me, you are also normal. And we can find often that in relationships, one person's like the light switch and the other person is like, I have very sensitive brakes. There's lots of brakes on the train track happening for me. And that's where they'll feel like, oh God, there's this disconnect. Like we have mismatched libidos. Honestly, like you kind of have to have a mismatched libido because otherwise nobody would leave the house. Like we've got to have a little bit of that to function, right?
So as far as communication goes, you know, I've had plenty of relationship experts on the show that have talked about just the importance of communication. You know, the importance of communication. You talked about if your wife, girlfriend is like asking you to do something and then you just don't do it, or you give her more stress about the things she was asking you to do, she's going to be even more turned off sexually. But let's just say that, you know, life does happen. Like you said, people have kids, people have a stressful job. Do you recommend like couples checking in the morning with each other to see how they're feeling, like from a stress perspective, so that they can kind of figure out like how to navigate that day to make sure that, you know, if that's the night that they're going to have sex, that the mood is right because they've communicated how they're feeling?
This is such a great point that you raise. So I definitely think decompressing at the end of the day and talking about how your days were. So as a whole family in my household, we have an avocado and a pit that we do. So, you know, the avocado, like a ripe avocado, that's the good stuff of your day. And then there's the pit. And we talk about like the things that were hard that we had to overcome. And that's something we do as a family, because I want my boys to understand that like every day has it can have its pits and build resiliency, but also understand like the sweet spots, the wonderful things that can happen in your day. And I think even if you don't have children, doing that as a couple is really important, that you unpack all of that stuff. And if it's certainly if it's relationship stuff, doing that privately so that you can get vulnerable, you can unpack all of that. You don't go to sleep with the burden of the stress of that day is important. And I think, you know, checking in the night before of what does your day look like tomorrow? Because then you already know what's coming. So my husband and I will check in and I'll be like, what does your day look like tomorrow? And if he's like, my day is stacked with meetings and I've got like all of this stuff going on. And I know that like, okay, my day is a little bit easier. I'm like, I'm going to take on breakfast tomorrow. I'm gonna handle breakfast tomorrow and I'm gonna step up and I'm gonna help in. And having that kind of balance, we're both working parents, having that balance is important. Now, to your point, if you are somebody who has a really busy schedule, has kids, you may need to be scheduling sex. There's nothing wrong with scheduling sex unless scheduling sex feels like a burden. If it feels like an obligation, that puts people out of the mood sometimes. But it is something that in this day and age, especially if you have young children, you do need to schedule. There's a lot of people that talk about scheduling date nights. I think that's important too. I also encourage my patients have sex before your date night. Like when the babysitter shows up, give the kids, then go have sex, then go out. You have more energy at the beginning of the night. If somebody like has a meltdown and you have to come home from your date, like you that doesn't disrupt things. So we have to get kind of creative in those ways. But as you were saying, the checking in about things, super, super important. And understanding, like there's people that are like, I want sex to be spontaneous. I want it to just be this thing that naturally happens. It's not the way it is for a lot of people, especially people who are working, who have busy lives, who are like in modern society, there's not always spontaneity. It's sometimes got to be scheduled out. It's got to be pre-planned and it's got to be communicated. Now, here's the fun fact from the research is people who talk about sex have better sex, and not just talking about like, what do they like, but actually talking about sex as a whole in their relationship, they have much better sex.
Staying on this theme of communication and talking about sex, you know, a lot of times people will just have sex and that'll be it. They'll just do the thing, right? And as you talk about, like, there's way more that needs to happen or should happen for people to properly orgasm, for the sex life to be healthy and thriving. I'm sure it can be awkward for some people, especially if they haven't had sex yet, to talk about certain things they like, certain things that turn them off, certain things they prefer in the bedroom. Or how do you advise people starting to have these conversations as a couple? Let's just say they're in a new relationship, they're looking to explore their sex life and get that going. What types of questions do you think will best serve each other so that it can be as effective as possible in the bedroom?
Well, first and foremost, you need to know your body and you need to know what you like, what's important to you. And this, you know, what you really brought up is the conversation of consent. Now, at our age, that's a relatively new concept, right? It's not something that like, I mean, there was no acronym for consent when I was growing up and coming of age, and now there is. And so that is really how the conversations need to start. So it's consent is going to be things that are, you know, when you're talking about sex, is that you don't have to like explicitly go down a checklist. And consent doesn't always have to be exclusive, contractually kind of based in the beginning. It can be something that evolves as things go. And what we understand about communication about sex is that a lot of people are turned on by dirty talk, so to speak. And I think this is important for people to know because they feel like, oh, it's awkward. Like if we're having sex, then I have to ask permission all the time. Permission can be sexy. Like you can say, I'd like to do X, Y, and Z. Is that something that you're into? Or, you know, would you like that? That is asking consent. That is getting that is communicating, getting consent. And you may be turning that person on even more. If you are the person who's like, no, not at all. I don't want anything to do with that. The other thing that can be really helpful is rather than being like, no, I'm not interested at all. No, I don't like that. Is saying, ooh, if you actually did this, like I would really like that. So that's where it comes to like knowing yourself and how you know, I hear a lot from people that are like, oh, consent kills the mood. Actually, consent done right really enhances the mood altogether. And if it comes to navigating this conversation and you're like, I feel confused, consent should always be enthusiastic. If it's a, okay, that's not enthusiastic. That's not really consent. And that's worth pausing and exploring and going further with. And so I think, you know, rather than just being like, oh, here are the things that you should absolutely discuss before you have sex, it's first starting with understanding, what are your boundaries? What are the things that you like? What are the things that are hard stops for you? And how do you communicate when it's like, no, I don't feel comfortable in that situation, but you do want things to keep going?
And so do you believe that the more emotionally connected two people are, the better the sex will be?
You know, it really depends. It really depends on so many variables because, right, we've got personalities, we've got contexts, like the situations that things are happening in. But what I will say is based on the research, if you ask people, think of the best sex of your life, absolute best sex of your life, tell me what made it great. Orgasm is not top of the list. Top of the list is intimacy, vulnerability, connection. So to that, if you do have that emotional intimacy already, then it would lend itself to having better sex, at least as people report what makes good sex.
And so I'd love to like get into the anatomy, the vagina and the clitoris and stuff like that, because I've heard you talk that we've essentially done ourselves a disservice by not really providing proper sex ed to people. And obviously a lot of guys aren't familiar with the anatomy of the vagina, and even some women just aren't totally familiar with everything. So as it pertains to this conversation, talk about the anatomy of the vagina. I mean, what parts are important when it comes to sex, orgasms, and what might be overlooked? Because I think a lot of times people just think of it as just intercourse and that's it. But I know you know it's so much more than that.
I love that you bring that up, because when it comes to sex education, which is seriously lacking in terms of medical accuracy in this country, we only have a handful of states, about 18, that have medically accurate sex education, which means that, I mean, if it's not medically accurate, it's not accurate. The rest of it is propaganda, belief, somebody else's agenda coming into play. And that's really problematic, because when you talk about sex ed, it's not sex that we're just talking about, right? We're talking about anatomy, talking about physiology. And when a lot of sex ed is, the perspective it's coming from is really male-centered. A penis goes in a vagina, a baby comes out of a vagina, you have a period. And it's not really getting to the details of the anatomy piece, but also the details of the physiology of how hormones change and how those affect you. And I think it's so important for people to understand that the parts that matter when we talk about sex are the parts that matter to you. However, we do know from the research that roughly only about 18% of women can orgasm with vaginal penetration alone. That means the clitoris is not touch. The clitoris is the primary way that women orgasm. And as you brought up, a lot of men aren't taught this. A lot of women aren't taught it either. And, you know, when I talk about this on social media, I sometimes get comments from women who are like, men just don't care about women's pleasure. Men are trash, you know, all these things. And I honor that they've had these experiences. But my experience in talking to many men is that they feel frustrated. They feel there's a great amount of pressure in society that they're supposed to be pleasuring a woman, satisfying a woman, being the stallion that goes forever, but like nobody gave them the tools or the roadmap to understand how that even happens. And this comes right back to what you're talking about, communication. The best way to know how to pleasure your partner is to communicate to your partner, but it also helps to understand anatomy. And as I write about in the book, so I actually gave several clitoral diagrams so that people can understand the clitoris as it relates to the vulva, which is the outside, the vagina is the inside. So that they can really understand like where is the clitoris? It's not just the outside, there's the structure inside. And like, what does this even look like? Because most medical textbooks don't even have it. In fact, it was the mid 1800s that the first documented dissection of the clitoris was performed. And then it was taken out of medical textbooks in the 1900s. And the beginning of the 1900s, And it wasn't until the late 1990s that it was once again acknowledged. And people were like, the clitoris has been discovered. And it was so laughable because it wasn't discovered. It was hidden. And somebody finally got noisy enough and started talking about it. And everybody was ready to acknowledge it. So I bring this all up so people understand that if they were hiding it from doctors, and you feel frustrated because you're like, why didn't I know this? Understand, there's a whole community in medicine who's frustrated because we should have had this information long ago.
And so now that we have this information and that you've written this book and that you've done a lot of research on this, how can we take what we know now and apply it so that, let's just say, two people were in the bedroom, guys like trying to figure out how to properly stimulate sexually their partner. Based on the research, like, what do women actually want from their man in the bedroom?
We always have to ask the individual, but we do have research on this as well. So rhythmic, there's got to be a rhythm to the movement. So if you're stimulating the clitoris, rhythmic movement, not too much pressure and not too little pressure. Okay. So sometimes people are like, oh, go really light. That can be irritating to people. So it's usually just medium pressure, rhythmic motion, circular, or maybe back and forth. That's what the research says the majority of clitoral owners will enjoy. But you also have to ask the individual because there might be something else that works for them. There might be something else that they enjoy. Depending on where they're at in the cycle, they may be craving something different because of where their hormones are at. And that is, again, where communication leads to better sex.
When it comes to that, again, like, I'm a guy, so I'm just thinking from a guy's brain. Guy's like, all right, like, I know what to do. I'm just going to go and I'm going to touch the clitoris and everything's going to be good. Research says that's what I got to do. What's the buildup like to that? Because I know that more probably has to happen. I mean, should there be, you know, intense kissing, making out? You know, is there certain, does a guy use his tongue, his finger? Like, based on the research, like talk about the buildup and like if a guy wants to have his best chances with in pleasuring the person that he's with, like, what needs to happen?
Yeah, this is really interesting that you bring this up because this can also change cyclically as well. So around ovulation, this is actually what research has called the sexual phase of the menstrual cycle. And that is the ramp up of estrogen and testosterone preceding ovulation, the day of ovulation, and then roughly the day after. So we're talking about 5 to 6 days out of the cycle where estrogen is higher. So fantasizing about sex can be up. The brain has more sexual fantasies that it's running, typically not in everybody. The tissue is much more responsive because of both estrogen and testosterone. Estrogen is how we self-lubricate. So that's an important hormonal component. And so during this phase, it may be very little foreplay is needed. By the way, as we use the term foreplay, I think it's important for people to understand that foreplay is sex and it can be enough and it can be satisfying and everybody can be happy. But often when we talk about foreplay, people have it in their mind that the end game must be penetration. And it doesn't have to be. Maybe that's not even what either of you are interested in, or something, you both orgasm before that ever happened. Perfectly fine. Now, what we do understand is that once you ovulate, what is formed in the ovaries is the corpus luteum, and that produces progesterone. And, you know, if you think about it from basically an evolutionary perspective, the hormones are gearing up of being like, we're about to ovulate. Let's capture some sperm. Let's have that sperm and egg meet, and then we'll get pregnant. Once you pass ovulation and you go into progesterone heavy phase, the luteal phase, That opportunity is gone. Progesterone doesn't care. Progesterone's like, I'm about, you got to tend and befriend and you need to, like, you know, take care of yourself. You might be pregnant. And during that phase, that's where women can find that it's more difficult to self-lubricate. That's actually normal because estrogen is now taking a back seat to progesterone. There may need to be a lot more stimulation and foreplay. So it might be like you have to have a heavy makeout session and maybe you do that and it doesn't go anywhere, but maybe that has to happen. Whatever it is in that relationship that does it for those people, there might have to be just a lot more. Now, as you get into the late luteal phase, so that's like 5 to 7 days before the period, that's where PMS symptoms can start to set in. And depending on that individual's hormones, they might be a lot more sensitive to stress. So the things like, you know, weaponized incompetence is what it's called when somebody outright does not perform a task correctly just so that they never have to do it again. That could make somebody lose their mind, or they might feel just like really stressed by any little thing. As progesterone begins to decline before the period, that is a time where someone can feel a lot more tender, a lot more sensitive. And so it may look like needing more cuddling, needing more support, needing more conversations. And we don't often think about all of these things as being, you know, a ramp up to sex, but those acts may need to happen first so that that individual's nervous system can feel that they're safe, that they're in a safe environment to be made vulnerable enough to be naked with somebody else. So, you know, what I wanted just to illustrate here is how there can be a peak, there can be a phase where it's like, it takes very little stimulation to get someone in the mood, to get them to orgasm. And then there may be a phase that happens, you know, just a week later where it's like, it's going to take a lot more of that support of the nervous system, a lot more of tending to that individual. And again, this comes back to communication. I will say that almost nobody likes if you just go straight for the clitoris and you're just like, I'm not going to do any warm up, nothing, just go. And, you know, to understand this, embryologically speaking, the clitoris and the penis are the same tissue. And if you are a penis owner and you're like, I don't understand a clitoris owner, but you do a bit, my friend, because you understand that there has to be stimulation in order to achieve an erection, that psychological stressors can impact the ability to achieve an erection. The clitoris also has to become erect. There also has to be this ramp up, this stimulation, and that stress can absolutely impact that tissue because they are the exact same tissue. They're just looking different because of different chromosomes and different hormones affecting them.
So you already answered one of my other questions, which was how important is it for somebody to understand their partner's cycle? And so you just touched on like why it's incredibly important to do so. And then you also brought up a really good point that like there's so many people that are just sexually stimulated by intellectual conversations and vulnerability and stuff like that. And it all makes sense given that most people, I would say, have to feel emotionally and physically safe. I mean, everybody has to feel physically safe, but I would say most people also have to feel emotionally safe if they're going to have sex with somebody. I want to talk a little bit about hormones. We've talked about the stress hormones, cortisol, you've brought up progesterone and testosterone and estrogen. How does this all come together with regards to intimacy and sex? Like I've heard that like when you cuddle, there's more like oxytocin, but sex, there's more dopamine. Like how do you understand how all of the hormones interact when it comes to sex?
Absolutely. So oxytocin is such a great hormone to bring up. It is really so great at keeping us youthful and happy and chilled out and combating the negative effects of cortisol. Now, cortisol is not all bad. We need it. It keeps inflammation in check. It helps with immune function. There's so much great things, many great things cortisol does. But if we are in a high stress state, why hugs can feel so good, or petting your dog can feel so good, or having sex is because that oxytocin release. And when oxytocin gets released, it really puts the hush on cortisol. And we also know that it's so good for brain health as well. So your body does crave these kinds of connections. It's something that it doesn't always have to be sex, right? We love to talk about orgasms releasing oxytocin, but even if you don't have an orgasm, you're still going to release oxytocin. Like this is something that just from that intimacy, but you also can get a 20-second hug from somebody and that can help. We know what's interesting in the research is that if you look at children and when they're stressed, they'll seek out their moms because just being connected with their mom helps them emotionally regulate. And it's not just about like, oh, because mom's going to comfort you. It is that oxytocin, that bonding hormone that can help so much. So we understand how important it is in helping mitigate the negative effects of a stress response. But as I said to you, like that's the tricky thing, is that stress will also keep you out of the mood. And that is normal. It's also normal if stress, I think there are some people that are, they like their body, their biology innately knows how good sex can be for getting you out of a stressful state, for helping you shift your physiology and your biochemistry rapidly, that there are people that when they get stressed, they want more sex. And what is that? They want more connection. They want more bonding. They want to feel that support. And you know, while we talk sometimes about libido being a sex drive, and there really is no drive, like you don't die, right? Like there's a drive to eat, there's a drive to drink water, but there is a drive for social connection. As we understand from the research, people who have community, who have support, they live longer. It's one of the absolute critical factors, right? Whenever they're looking at blue zones, they're always like, it's their diet. I'm like, I wish it was that simple. Those people actually have phenomenal communities and support systems. And that is part of what we're talking about. And so I want people just to understand that, like, it doesn't always have to be sex to be able to shift your biochemistry, but you do have a drive. As a human, you are a communal species to have that connection with someone else.
Talking about orgasm, how do you define an orgasm? Like, what's going on physiologically? And how do you know if somebody's faking one?
Yeah. As we know from the movie Harry Met Sally, men don't know when women are faking them. And whenever I talk about the research that, like, a lot of women report, almost 90% of women report they've faked at least one orgasm. You know, there's men who get really mad and they're just like, how are they so deceitful? And they, you know, and they have their like past history. I'm like, whoa, whoa, whoa. If you ask women, why have you faked an orgasm? It is altruistic deceit. That is, they do it for your ego. They do it so that you still feel good. They do it because they understand that society has put pressure on you to perform in a certain way, and they don't want you to feel bad. And even when the sex is bad for them, when they're like, oh, this is just like not great, they'll still fake it because they want you to feel good. And if you ask women, they're like, it's so important to me that my partner feels good about themselves. Not just that they physically feel good and that they ejaculate, but they actually feel good about themselves. So when women are faking it, it's not because they hate you. It's actually because they really like you. And the caveat is that sometimes it's painful for various reasons. Maybe it's where they're at in their cycle. Maybe they have a condition. Like I talk about various conditions that could cause pain with sex in the book. Maybe there's something going on and they're just like, this is not going to be good for me. And I need it to be over, but I want it to still be really good for them. And I know this excites them. And so again, you know, there are very few women that report that they fake it because they don't like the person. And they're just like, oh, I just want this to be over. That's not the primary reason women fake it. Now, if you blindfold the best of sex experts, so they don't know whether it is a man, woman, anybody out there who's reporting an orgasm, they can't tell you the difference. They cannot tell you who it is. No gender can they define an orgasm, because people almost universally explain it the same way. It's mounting, building, tension, pressure, and then a big release. That's pretty much the gist of what people, and you know, for as amazing as they are, the whole description of it sounds kind of like pretty wah wah, like not that great, but that's really, you know, at the crux of it, how people will describe an orgasm. You can't tell if a woman fakes an orgasm. It's not something that, you know, necessarily you'll be able to understand, but that's where you hope that there is good communication around it. And you know, it's always okay. I think it's really important for either partner to understand that it is okay to say, hey, I'm not going to get there, but I'm still really enjoying myself. There's a lot of pressure around the orgasm, and that can be frustrating for men and for women, because they can feel like, oh God, like this is the thing we're supposed to achieve. And if we can't achieve it, something's wrong with me. And then we start spiraling in our minds, and that takes us even more out of the moment. But like I said, the orgasm, they're great, but they're not the most important part of sex. And you can have a completely wonderful shared moment without ever achieving an orgasm. And that can be perfectly satisfactory and sometimes even better than the sex where you did achieve an orgasm.
And it's so funny how humans are wired, right? We're afraid to like open up and share certain things because of the fear of what the other person's going to think. But yet if we don't share, it's going to create more distrust and, you know, a more of an unhealthy relationship, right? So I just think it's just like anything. It's like, okay, these conversations around sex and, you know, saying you like something, saying you didn't like something, they're challenging because the risk is you end up hurting your partner. But if you find out 3 months down the road, 6 months down the road, that this person didn't really like anything you were doing, well, then how hurt? That person's going to be even way more hurt. So like, wait a second, like, why didn't you tell me any of this? What are some of the other maybe like hidden erogenous zones on women that people might not be aware of? I mean, people talk a lot about the G-spot, but obviously we've talked about the clitoris. What are some other areas?
Okay, so firstly, I do want people to understand. So I think we should talk about the orgasm gap because, you know, we were talking about women faking orgasms. And I think before we leave the clitoris, it's really important to understand that is the way the majority of women orgasm. And we know from the research that roughly only about 18% of women report that they can orgasm with vaginal penetration alone. So this is really important to understand because from the research, we have a huge differential in the number of people having orgasms in heterosexual relationships. So if you ask you take this survey and you look at men versus women, 95% of men report climaxing during partnered sex, whereas 65% of women report having an orgasm with their male partner. So it's a huge gap. And in some places, you'll find people saying, well, that's just because, like, you know, women are faking it and there's all of these problems, or it's just so difficult to make a woman orgasm. However, the research has also shown us that if you take a lesbian couple and you ask, you know, this group of lesbians, like, what is your percent of orgasming? They're reporting 86%. So there is a wider differential in terms of a heterosexual relationship who is actually having an orgasm. And again, this comes back to knowledge about the clitoris. And what I get so upset with is this whole concept of, like, you know, men just don't care or anything. They care very much. But when I tell you that the clitoris isn't even in a standard anatomy textbook that teaches doctors, like, what chance do men stand? So clitoris, definitely like the holy grail of making an orgasm happen. Regarding the G-spot, that one is super, super debatable. There are lots of people that say it doesn't exist. It hasn't really been well defined in the research or proven that this structure actually exists. However, what has been shown is that the clitoris isn't just the external structure. So when I was talking about, like, okay, what does research say about the type of stimulation the clitoris likes? Okay, I was talking about just the outside, just the vulva. But the clitoris actually extends inside. So you've got the clitoris at the top, and then it's got these branches like a wishbone that come down and they're around the vagina. So it begs the question, these women, this 18%, when they're like, oh yeah, I can orgasm with vaginal penetration alone, or is it that there's stimulation of the internal clitoris and the G-spot? Is that a thing, or is there stimulation of the internal clitoris? Now, there's also women who report liking their cervix stimulated. That is something that has to happen with deep penetration. This is the point of the uterus that is closest. So it's the terminal end. That is, that's where period blood comes out. That is where sperm makes its way up to the fallopian tubes to fertilize an egg. That is what dilates and expands for a small human to pass out of. That is the the cervix. Some women report liking to having their cervix stimulated. That I want people to also understand that depending on where she's at in her cycle will also dictate whether or not she's able to have deep penetration. In some instances, it's not true for everyone, but when you're on your period, and around your period, the uterus is actually lower down. So the cervix is going to be lower down. If you ever hit a cervix, you ram it, you run into it, that pain is like equivalent to being kicked in the testicles. It is does not feel good. So please understand that. But around ovulation, the uterus is all actually up higher. And so that's why I was saying, like, talking to your partner, because that's a time where, like, doggy style is a lot easier than when you're on your period, just by the anatomy and everything that's taking place. So we talked about the clitoris, the vulva, the so what people call the labia majora, the outer lips, the inner lips, the labia minora, those can be very sensitive to stimulation as well. I have an entire chapter in the book dedicated to breasts. The nipples are a complete erogenous zone for everybody out there, okay? Not everybody might be into it, but everybody has nerves that are on their nipples, and the nipples and then the little discs that they sit on, those are the areola. And through nipple play, some people can achieve an orgasm. Some people, they will stimulate their nipples to help with bringing on labor, because it can help with releasing oxytocin. So I talk about in the book, you know, when somebody is like in that late luteal phase, if you haven't tried breast play before, not the good time to jump into that necessarily, because they can be a lot more sensitive because of the way those tissues are. But actually, first couple of days of the period and leading up into ovulation, that phase of the cycle, someone might be more receptive. Now, why I bring up all these differences of like what's happening in the cycle is because if you don't have a cycle, it can be very confusing of why one minute you're totally into me and the next minute you're not. Why one minute you're all about this and the next minute you're not. And it can feel that way, but it's really just the shifts and the changes. And I think it's very easy for us to internalize things and be like, oh God, they're not that into me right now. And like, I must have done something wrong, rather than checking in, like, where are you at in your cycle and what's going on for you? And like, what else happened in your day? Because maybe it had nothing to actually do with you. So understand there's a lot of erogenous zones. I hit on a few of them, but it also depends on your partner. And as I talk about in the book, I mean, there's been the phenomenon of thinking off, where people can literally have an orgasm just thinking, and they can think their way into an orgasm. Some people accidentally have an orgasm by working out their core at the gym. Some people accidentally have an orgasm because they're sleeping and they hold their pee too long. And then they're like, I had an orgasm. I don't recommend trying to have a pee-gasm, okay? Because you could get a UTI. Like, let's not do that. So there's a lot of ways to an orgasm. And what I think is just so cool is that from the research on people who have had spinal cord injuries and they lose sensitivity below the waist, their nervous system will set up new pathways for pleasure, which tells you how important it is. If it wasn't important, the body would forgo it. The body would be like, forget it. Just, we lost it. We're done with it. Don't need it. But instead, there are people that can have spinal cord injuries, and now when they get their abdomen stroked a certain way, they end up having an orgasm because the nerves have now regrown. And the brain is really the ultimate sexual organ, that it's picking up on that stimuli, and they can achieve orgasm.
So generally speaking, I know obviously every individual is going to be different. Would you say women overall, based on research, prefer like a more like medium pressure, you know, not too light, but not incredibly tough?
Especially very Goldilocks.
Does this also relate, like, talk about breasts and nipples, does that relate to that as well? Like the same type of thing, like circular motion and just like medium pressure?
Well, not necessarily circular motion, but medium pressure is always the best way to start, because too light starts to feel like a tickle. It also can be irritating to some people. Like, it actually could go the opposite way. And then too much pressure, if the tissue is tender or sensitive at all, like, that's going to be uncomfortable. It's always better to start with that. So not super light, like not like a feather, unless they've asked for a feather, but going a little more pressure, and then asking less or more. That way, you know, getting that feedback in real time is the best way to know. Because again, it depends on so many variables of their physiology, but also their psychological state as well.
All right. So fill in this for me. Men think women want this, but they really want that.
Oh gosh. There's a lot of things that can fit in that. You know, men think women want somebody who can, like, you know, go forever in the bedroom and, like, you know, is just a Casanova or Fabio, right? And what they really want is somebody who can make them feel safe and hold space for making them feel vulnerable and can meet them at a place of having pleasure for pleasure's sake and not necessarily like a time limit. It's so interesting to me because you'll see in movies where they'll make jokes about like, oh yeah, like, you know, you guys are having sex for like less than 10 minutes. And, you know, and it's like this joke of like, oh, you don't have a great sex life. However, I'm like, how are you defining that? If that is like sexual intercourse, that may be a long time for somebody like that, like in terms of like, that's perfectly fine. Like, and in fact, maybe she already had like 3 orgasms before they even got started. And then they started, she had another one and everybody's happy and satisfied. But you see these things in the media as if like the time absolutely matters. But the reality is that when we're defining sex, we need to broaden that definition because it's not just vaginal penetration. It's not just sexual intercourse. It is so much more than that. And I think what's so important, like as you framed it, like, you know, men think women want this and like the pressure it puts on men to be guessing at what women want. And whenever I see men on the internet being like, men, this is what women want. And I'm like, why are you listening to other men right. about what women want? Just ask the woman, what do you want? Like, ask her what she wants. Communicate with her. That is going to bring the satisfaction with the individual, right? Because that's what you're really after. And it's interesting because I asked on Threads, like, why do men do this? Like, real question. Like, what's going on? There were men who were like, women lie and they don't know what they want. And I'm like, fair. Some women do not know what they want because they've never given permission to actually state what they want or think that it's okay to ask for what they want. Or they've never been in a relationship where they feel that it's a safe enough place to explore all of that. So there are a lot of reasons why maybe she doesn't feel safe or she doesn't know exactly what she wants, or maybe she doesn't know what's possible for what she wants. And that is, I'm like, if that's how you feel, that she doesn't know what she wants, like, what an opportunity in a relationship for both of you to work together. Like, how exciting. That's like going on an adventure together. Like, how amazing is that? You know, when they're like, they lie. Well, no, actually women don't necessarily lie. Like we talked about, there's that altruistic deceit where like, she doesn't want you to feel bad and she cares about you so deeply that she doesn't want you to feel bad. But the other thing that came up is men said, I don't know how to talk to a woman about this. I'm like, that is really like, you feel safer talking to another man and asking another man, what do women want? However, if you're a man and you've been with a woman and you figure out what she wants, no, that doesn't mean that's what all women want. And vice versa. If a woman is with a man, it doesn't mean she knows what all men want. And I think we get too reductionistic in being like, just because you're this, you know, you identify as this gender, this must be what you want and the way things are. We really need to stand back and respect the individual. Because as I was talking about that whole like gas pedal brake system and putting on the brakes, when I talk about that, I get men who come into my DMs and they're like, this is me. And I've been made to feel in society like something's wrong with me because I should just be turned on all the time and it should be just so easy for me to get in the mood. And yet if I feel stressed out, it's very hard for me and I have to talk about my feelings. I'm like, that's awesome. Because again, the more vulnerable you can get with your partner emotionally, the better sex you're going to have.
Right. And I also think part of the problem is there's been a lot of talk over the years that like sex defines the relationship. That if the sex isn't good, your relationship will suffer. You'll hear people say like, I don't want to wait too long in my relationship to have sex because what if it's not good? But what we've been talking about, what you're saying is like the research is pretty clear that the more emotionally connected and vulnerable you can be with your partner, the better that the sex is going to be. So I just hope that we can kind of get past that. And while sex is certainly important for a relationship, it's not the end all be all. There's so many other things that are more important when it comes to that, that will lead to better sex long term.
Absolutely. And, you know, to your point, I think people do get worried about that. Like, what if the sex is bad? Then there's an opportunity to work and to grow together. You know, sometimes I think about like when people are like, oh, sex is bad. And I'm like, you know, but like, it's also kind of like pizza, where it's like, even when you have bad pizza, you're like, oh, it's still pizza. And it's still pizza. And like, what could I tweak? What could we do about that? And it's, you know, there are, I think the time when sex, when women will say this sex was really bad, is when they felt neglected, ignored. Their partner was maybe self-absorbed, not actually, like, their partner was essentially just going through the motions of sex and using their body as a means to an end. That makes for bad sex, and there is no opportunity to actually grow and have better sex. And that person that, like, you know, is just basically using somebody as a means to an end, they have their own work to do. I want people to understand that if you find yourself in a relationship with that person, you are not their therapist. You are not the person that is there to fix them. And if they need to go do their own work, bless them and send them on their way. Nobody's entitled to your body. I don't even care if you're married. They're not entitled to your body. And in fact, if you want to make a woman just completely, like, just be repulsed, act as if she owes you sex, that you that she has to give you sex. You know, I will see men talking about how, like, well, I go to work all day, so at the end of the day, I need this. And I'm like, I hear that. And nobody owes you their body. And if you feel like at the end of the day, I need this, why do you need this? When you unpack that and someone's willing to be honest, it is usually like, I'm stressed. I need to feel connected. I need to feel held. I need to feel like somebody is supporting me and loving me and nurturing me. Fantastic. Now, your partner also needs to feel that as well. And when men get like, oh, women are just withholding sex, you know, and they get really angry about that, I think it's really important that they understand that when you're talking about sex in a heterosexual relationship, there is a level of vulnerability to have somebody enter your body that you absolutely have to feel safe. You absolutely have to feel safe. And if you, it doesn't matter if you go to work all day. It doesn't matter if you're the breadwinner. None of that matters to her nervous system on the primal level. And this is something that evolution has, we have not evolved so far that we could just get past this. And she can just change her mind about it, or just be like, she has to feel safe and taken care of. And that is not just, I protect her and I make money. That is that you actually take care of her emotions and her, and you care about her as an individual. And why I really want to drive that home is because it can feel like rejection. It can feel so painful when you have been at work all day and you come home and you're like, I just want to connect with you. And this person isn't able to. It feels like rejection and it hurts. But a lot of times it's not a conscious decision. It is what's actually being run by that primal nervous system. And that's what we have to work on and get over, so that ultimately you both can achieve the same goal and have that connection.
Going back to the insecurities with men, I got to ask the question, does size matter?
No, actually, that's such a, this is something that, like, it does matter, actually, but not in the way that you think it does. I have a friend, Dr. Gio Espinosa. I love him. I think all men should follow him. He is a naturopathic urologist and acupuncturist. And we get into conversations, man, and he's just like, it is the well-hung men that have the worst sex lives and feel the most frustrated. So the vaginal canal is only so large. It is only so large. I talk about something called the O-ring in my book. You can actually put a ring and that can help with depth of penetration so that things don't go so deep. But often how people think about size mattering is that they're like, oh gosh, if you're too small. Well, the primary way that women orgasm is through clitoral stimulation. And most penises are not going to stimulate the clitoris anyways. So it actually doesn't matter in terms of if you want to achieve an orgasm, if you want to have, you know, really, there's so many different types of sex, having that connection, having that pleasure, having that you know, satisfaction, the size of the penis doesn't actually matter. And people certainly have their preferences. But the one caveat I will say is that a long penis, that is something that can be difficult for some women to be able to accommodate, because there is just genetic just limitations in terms of that anatomy. But we now know, I think it's actually called the O-nut. I think I called it something else, but they're rings that you can put on the penis that controls the depth of penetration. And then I also talk about other things that can be done so that the depth of penetration can be modulated, so it doesn't become painful, right? We don't want to run into the uterus and at the same time, still getting the stimulation for the male partner. So I know that a lot of men are told, like, I hate to break it to you, but it's just not all about the penis. And there's so much more that you can do outside of having penetrative sex.
Have you found, just through research, is there like an outside of, I mean, obviously when men think about sex, they think about the penis. Is there any other part of their body that's been found to sexually stimulate a woman? Like either like the tongue, the hand, the finger, like,
what? Of course. People are very creative. There are lots of things. So this is also where, tongues, fingers, thighs, like, I mean, it's just about stimulation, right? This is also where, a lot of people, men in particular, will feel intimidated by sex toys. They will feel like it's an enemy. And I'm like, it is your ally. Pretend you are Batman and it is part of your tool belt. Like, it is one of the tools that you can utilize and you can bring into play. But I think why men often, so here's part of where that comes from, is that for a man, most men, they ejaculate and it's over. And what we know from research is that some men, if they're masturbating on their own, they're not satisfied in their relationship. It's actually all this is opposite for women. Women can have multiple orgasms. Having an orgasm before penetrative sex can actually make it even better in some instances. Women, we know from this is from studies, if they're masturbating relationship, you're doing a good job, because she's sexually satisfied and she's happy in her relationship. Women who masturbate tend to be very happy with their partners. And that is something I think men have been told, that, like, you know, if she has to seek it elsewhere, then you're not doing your job. Simply not true. And in fact, if she orgasms earlier in the day, she might be more inclined to be in the mood when you do get home. So definitely toys should be, like, seriously, be Batman, have your tool belt, like, use your ally, like, you know, Batman, like, he, like, you know, he's able to do so many cool things because he's got this tool belt. So are you. And then, you know, in terms of, you know, men with stimulation, you know, it's not always just about their penis either. There's a lot of things that men will report, and each are individual, but we know that, like, prostate stimulation, for example, not a lot of men want to admit that publicly, but there are a lot of men who enjoy that in the bedroom. And that doesn't say anything about your sexual orientation or your masculinity. It's just another part of your body that brings pleasure.
Isn't the male G-spot in the prostate?
Yeah, that's what they call it.
I know you talk about overall health and wellness and hormones. We talk a lot about that on the show as well. So talk about the importance of just taking care of your overall, like, health and wellness as it relates to your sexual health.
Oh, let's talk about insulin. So back when I was getting my nutrition degree, like 20 years ago, erectile dysfunction. If you had erectile dysfunction, the first thing we wanted to investigate was the cardiometabolic health. Do you have heart disease or do you have diabetes? You have both until we've proven otherwise. Like, that is the first thing that we start thinking. This is important to understand, that there's a lot of research done on men that can't be applied to women, but research done on erectile dysfunction due to cardiometabolic issues on the penis, we've got a lot of it that can be applied to the clitoris. And why is that? Because embryologically speaking, they're the same exact tissue. You were set up to have a clitoris until testosterone came in the first trimester. So mom's hormones came out, testosterone primarily. You had a Y chromosome. It had the certain gene that detected it, and you differentiated and you went away from the clitoris and you formed the penis. Those tissues are exactly the same. If we do a cross section, so we actually cut them and look at them, they got the same exact tissue, which means that insulin dysregulation, blood sugar dysregulation, something that is very rampant in this country, friends, step away from the ultra processed food because it hates your sex life. It will destroy it. Those things can absolutely impact your ability to get an erection, and the clitoris has to have an erection as well, to be able to have an erection and to be able to have an orgasm. So that's the insulin component. But when we have insulin dysregulation happening and our blood sugar is up, we also see that we have inflammation. In women's bodies, we can lead into an ovulatory cycle, so we're not actually ovulating. And some people are like, great, then I won't get pregnant. I don't want a baby. But you miss out on the sexual phase of the cycle, which is the whole cascade of estrogen ramping up, estrogen peaking, being high, and you feeling a lot, not just more sexual, but you feeling a lot more sexy, you feeling a lot more confident in your body as well. There's things outside of sex that all of these hormones are doing. And so foundational to your hormone health, but your sex life as well, is tending to your insulin. So eating fat, fiber, and protein at every single meal. Women need to be getting about 25 grams of fiber every day. Men need to be getting at least 30 grams of fiber every day. We all need to be eating enough protein, about 1 gram per kilogram of body weight. So making sure that you're getting at least that minimum amount of protein coming in. Healthy fats. My gosh, did the 90s try to sabotage our sex lives by telling us to go fat free? Like, what? No, we want healthy fats. So things like avocado, nuts, seeds, omega-3s coming from your cold water fish. And we also want to look at like grass-fed animal fats as well, because those are going to have your fat-soluble vitamins. So all of that is super, super important for sexual health. And then there's tending to our stress. Stress is seriously wreaking havoc at a cellular level. It is pro-aging, and it is very problematic. It's not just problematic of like, oh, I feel stressed out. Now I don't want to have sex. It can create hormonal chaos over time because your body has to continue adapting until it can't really adapt anymore. And it has to say to you, shut down all the systems. You need to rest. You need to recover. So I want people to understand, if you are not eating, sleeping, living in a way that your mom told you, you didn't know your mom was so interested in grandchildren, right? Like that, if you're not doing those things, that can definitely be problematic with your sex life. And those are very, very foundational things to overall health. What's really cool is the stuff that keep the ovaries and testes youthful, producing the hormones that they need to be. They're also the things that are great for your heart, your brain, your bones, longevity overall. And we know people who are having good sex, they're living longer. They have healthier hormones. They have less cardiometabolic issues.
We've covered so much. You answered all my questions, and this has been an amazing conversation. Is there anything else that you think my audience or people should know in general about some of those topics that we've discussed that maybe you haven't shared yet?
Definitely a key takeaway is that you live in your body. So you know you're normal. And if it doesn't feel like it's normal to you, then it's not normal. We don't want to get, like, when we talk about libido and orgasm, we don't want to compare ourselves to other people. We want to compare it to our baseline. What is our normal? And if you are a woman listening to this and your doctor's like, women just don't, they don't like sex. They're not that into it anyways. Oh, you're having pain with sex. No big deal. Or, you know, you just need to have more lube. I mean, there's a lot of times in our cycle we need to have more lube. That is normal. But if they're telling you there's nothing to investigate, that's not correct. If you notice a change in your libido, let's investigate your hormones, figure out what's going on. Let's try to understand, has your stress changed? Has your relationship changed? Do you have a gut infection? Like, it could be many things. And also, if you're not enjoying sex because it's painful, that might be the first sign that you have endometriosis, a vaginal infection. You might have something going on. And so this is all to say that while medicine very much Western medicine is like, oh, sex is just a bonus and a benefit if women get to have it and they actually enjoy it. That is false. And we know from the research that women do, in fact, want sex, like sex, enjoy sex. And if they're not, there's something going on that we need to investigate and support them in.
Well, Dr. Brighton, thank you so much for coming on. My audience, I think, is going to get a ton of value out of our conversation. If people want to pick up your books, if they want to learn more about your work, if they want to connect with you, where's the best place to do that?
You can find my books everywhere books are sold. And then you can also find me on my main hub, Dr. Brighton. So it's drbrighten.com, drbrighton.com. And there is a plethora of information there. Women call it the Google of women's medicine because they can find tons and tons of information beyond just sexual health, looking at things like perimenopause, menopause, gut health, and all the ways that our hormones can go off the rails and how to bring them back on the rails.
Amazing. Well, I'll be sure to include the links to that stuff in the show notes. And I thank you so much again for coming on. My audience is going to love this.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for having me. I enjoyed the conversation.
Likewise.